and what they have learned about the homeless and themselves as a result. You can find local folks at KBOO.FM. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on local folks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The New Year Dragon Dance Parade to celebrate the Year of the Rat begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and ends at the Oregon Historical Society. Live afternoon performances and activities will begin at 1:30 p.m. Again, that's Portland Chinatown's 5th Annual Lunar New Year Dragon Dance Parade on Saturday, January 25th from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The parade begins at Northwest 3rd and Davis at 11:30 a.m. and the activities and performances begin at 1:30 p.m. at the Oregon Historical Society, 1200 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. Information about the parade route, performers, and sponsors can be found at KBOO.FM on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to Hindsight 2020, a day of special programming debriefing the last 3 years of the Trump regime.
Captain Hindsight!
Thanks for listening.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive. My name is Emma Lugo and I use she and her pronouns.
And my name is Jean Bryant and I also use she and her pronouns.
And we are here tonight. We are going to be talking about the state of affairs 3 years into the disaster of the Trump administration and specifically how it's been affecting transgender, non-binary, two-spirit communities. So welcome.
Yeah.
So let's start with a review, Jean. It's been 3 years. How's it been going for you?
Oh, my goodness. You know, anytime I have a conversation around this, I'm going to open by saying things that are happening for me personally and also for, I think, the trans non-binary community at large. We always have to remember that these things are playing out in front of the backdrop of the larger context. I think that's really the theme for the show. And so there's this ambient, just constant anxiety that that we've been experiencing ever since this administration stepped into power. And so I have to acknowledge that. How's it going for me? Of course, well, I'm nervous. And at times I'm quite frightened. And so, you know, with that having been said, I have to say that it hasn't been as bad as my worst fears. I got to say that.
Mm-hmm. Me
you
too.
Know, really, it hasn't. So while, you know, politically, what's going on in this country is frightening. Culturally, I observe that, you know, we continue to make progress. I think as a broader coalition, LGBTIQ coalition.
Oh, definitely.
Within our culture.
There's so many of us.
Yeah, it's you know, it hasn't been as bad as I thought it would be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you, how did, you know?
Well, it's, you know, it's been really challenging. I mean, I remember, so going back 2016, I remember exactly where I was on the night of the election. I was kind of like a house party, and we were watching election results, and I just couldn't believe it. I remember like around 10 or 11 watching the results pull in, and I was just absolutely flabbergasted. I mean, first of all, I'm not either a Democrat or a Republican, so I don't really have a horse in the race, but I knew exactly what it meant to elect a fascist who made fun of people with disabilities and talked about grabbing people by their anatomy and different things. So I knew it was bad. I knew it was going to be really, really bad. And it has been just as bad as I ever imagined it would be. Not specifically from my identity as a trans person, but for me personally, from my other intersecting identities. I mean, but also my identity as a trans person, I personally experienced so much more fear now than I did 3 years ago. I mean, I had so much optimism in 2016. And again, I'm not either a Democrat or a Republican, but I will say that when you give people health care, you make their lives better. No matter who you give health care to.
When you give people protections in the arena of housing and employment, you make their lives better.
Exactly. And so for our communities, for our transgender and non-binary communities, I think that before that, the previous 8 years had been a time of increasing access, like at least to the promise of access to healthcare. And I think that specifically the Medicaid expansion that happened under the Affordable Care Act really opened the floodgates to transgender and non-binary people beginning to get access to things that so many people had not had, like in the previous generation of trans folks. And and I know based on my experience with folks who I consider like my trans elders, like my trans parents, my trans grandparents, folks who like within the community, I saw struggle like back in the 80s, for instance, like just to try to get stuff done. And I remember some of the narratives that people used to have back in the 80s and the 90s, even coming into the 2000s, was like, well, if you're transgender and you want to do something about it, like, first of all, you have to completely erase your identity so that like you don't exist anymore. You go someplace where nobody knows you.
Yeah.
And then you have to like get a job and you have to save tens of thousands of dollars. So forego like buying a house, forego getting married, forego having children or anything like that. And you've got to just get a job and save all your money, you know, just so that you can get health care, because health insurance is not going to cover you as a transgender person because you don't even exist. So that narrative has changed radically.
Yes, it has. Little civics lesson from Jean. The Medicare expansion or Medicaid expansion during the Obama era was, I think, one of the major triggering events for this shift. But folks have to realize that it was a policy based thing. It was something that was never really codified in law. It was an interpretation, actually a fairly thin legal interpretation at the time. The Obama administration, by executive order, which is different than a fully codified law, basically said anything or anybody who accepts federal funding into their business or and that extended to states and that kind of stuff, when they accepted the federal funding for the Medicaid expansion. Along with that came a policy that said you cannot discriminate based on gender identity. But it was always just a policy. And so it, thank goodness it took hold. it took hold, and our medical options and many of the insurance coverages and stuff that we enjoy today stemmed from that that one event. And you know, again, I'm trying to look at some of the bright sides. We haven't seen that erode. We haven't seen that erode. Right. Right. Even though this administration, one of the first things that happened when Trump took office was a systematic erasure of those policies, you know, from the executive branch of the Obama era. You know, have all been erased, but they haven't. It stalled our progress. It stalled our progress, but it didn't completely erase. They haven't succeeded in erasing us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's a cultural thing.
Exactly.
More than a political thing.
You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. We're part of a special all-day of programming looking back at 3 years, 3 years of this disaster that's happened to the United States, the past 3 years of the Trump administration, and how it's affected specifically transgender and non-binary mm-hmm. communities here mm-hmm. in the United States. One of the things that I'll say looking at the last 3 years, I kind of feel like we're on some sort of a sitcom, like where, like, you know, they go, oh, I remember when, and then they kind of show a flashback.
Show a flashback, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. It's like back in the days when sitcoms did that, it was a way of saving money and, you know.
Well, I suppose we could pull some of our shows from back then, too. But
Well, we could just talk about them, too.
Yeah.
I remember, like, I think that one of the things, like looking back on the last 3 years, that's really that everything is changing so fast right now. And it's really great how fast it is changing, because I think that when I talk about the narrative of like a narrative that was like maybe an 80s or 90s narrative from the last century, you know, I know people going even further back than that. I mean, I know people who go back to the Christine Jorgensen days, like way back in the 50s and 60s, like people who either their transition narratives began to be formed by them, and those were their elders, or even people who, like, they're just that far back. And so, like, we're talking, like, we can go back to Christine Jorgensen from the 1950s as kind of, like, one particular starting point within like a Western framework mm-hmm. for not Western, but maybe within like a white framework for how you might talk about these transition stories. There are so many other cultural interpretations for how you can talk about the transition narratives that don't mark like, you know, some particular like white celebrity person, but for the sake of having one narrative point, I might look at that and say, well, that was a narrative point that was popularized. So that was something that became a popular media expression. And for about 30 or 40 years, that was really like the narrative. That was like the Christine Jorgensen narrative of how you transition was the narrative.
Yeah.
And then sometime starting in the 80s or 90s, like that was like the narrative for like 40 years. Then things really started to change, and there were more narratives that like got introduced into the conversation, mm-hmm. including like transmasculine narratives.
Exactly. Exactly. And thank you, because I was going to you know, point that out as well. You know, we did a show. I don't know. I guess it was just this last spring where we had Dr. Jameson Green on, who is part of the WPATH and USPATH. And Jameson's a transmasculine individual who played major roles, you know, in the 1990s and early 2000s in moving a lot of things forward. And he had a lot to say about the transmasculine experience, you know, during that era as well.
Yeah, and so over time, what we've seen is like this decoupling from this narrative in like Western popular media that transition is like a white person who transitions from one particular gender to female gender, and then like kind of follows that life.
Still very binary based.
Very much binary based. Very much binary based. Yeah. And so like beginning in the 90s, we started to have like the addition of these narratives within popular media that like reflected a more realistic reflection of where the community really is. And it seems like things are just speeding up so fast now. Like now we're to a point where we're really trying to decouple like the entire framework of how like we look at things like culturally. I mean, especially people who have grown up with privilege and who have grown up without really questioning or understanding how colonization and how white privilege really affects how we think about our narratives of transition and our narratives of gender and gender expression. And like right now, everything is happening really quick. There's like this swooping going on and everything's sort of happening at once. One of the things that I've seen in the last 3 years that has been so great is there's this been an ascendancy of the trans masculine expression within our community. When I look at our community institutions, when I look at like who's really pushing the narrative, like in the last 3 years, it's been trans men more than it's been trans women.
Yes.
And for most of my adult life, it was trans women who were pushing the narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a reflection of kind of like an integration of power, you know, and the other thing that you're starting to see now, I mean, like with the election of people like Andrea Jenkins in Minneapolis and other folks, is you're starting to see trans people of color really being like pushing themselves into the center of the narrative in a way that like hasn't happened before within like our own community. And it's this acceptance, this understanding, this awareness that like, you know, we really need to center our conversations. If we're dealing with our own exclusions within the broader community, we need to make sure that like within our own internal conversations, we're like pushing people who have been excluded into the center of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's like a really positive development that in a lot of ways is really happening as a direct countervalence to what's going on with the Trump administration.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The polarization, not just in this country, this polarization is happening, you know, elsewhere as well. I know the United Kingdom is maybe even more polarized than we are in a lot of ways on some of these topics, but that polarization gives a very stark contrast, and so we're motivated.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we're
and thank
motivated.
Goodness,
yes.
You know. Again, trying to look. You know, it's like trying to look. I'm not even going to call it the bright side, but rather than just go, oh my goodness, it's like, no, you know what? It's time.
Mm-hmm.
Put on your boots.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go.
Yeah.
It's time.
I think also that one of the things that has changed our community so radically is the advent of social media. I think that social media has really like pushed our community in ways that like we never had. Like it's like this fuel. It really is. It's like this fuel, and it can go in lots of different directions.
Yes.
It doesn't always go in the best direction.
No.
But on the other hand, it's also like radically decentralizing in some ways, and it's a way of our voice, our community having voices in ways that it never had before, and also kind of having its own process, like its own way of voting.
Yes, absolutely. Social, you know, the internet and social media has caused, or not caused, it has given us the opportunity to form a community in ways that never existed before.
Mm-hmm.
For us.
Mm-hmm.
We never had that before.
And for a lot of people, like in, so this is this show is originating here in Portland, Oregon, if you're listening to us live on KBOO. But if you're listening online from someplace outside of Portland, understand that culturally here in Portland, we have a kind of a in Portland, I think it's fair to say we kind of have a a conversion of folks who are trans and non-binary.
Yes.
Some of it's that folks who are trans and non-binary come to the West Coast. They come to the West Coast cities, San Francisco, Seattle, Sacramento, Los Angeles,
yes.
Portland, Eugene. You know, they come here because they're trying to escape the South, you know. I mean, in all honesty, because mm-hmm. I mean, we had Paige Kreisman on, you know, earlier this year, and I mean, Paige told her story. Paige is a candidate for Oregon State House right now, and Paige told her story of coming from the South and how, you know, how like she didn't know if she was going to survive, honestly,
yeah.
living there, and you know. I mean, she came here just like so many of us. We came here really fleeing, you know, environments that we knew were not accepting, not welcoming, and where mm-hmm. many of us really felt in danger for our lives.
And yes, that's true. And so there, yes, over the last three, four, five, actually going back more like maybe 10 years mm-hmm. or so, and there are reasons why Oregon and Portland you know, have become kind of a safety zone in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It's generally more supportive here. It's a safer, a better environment. But I want to introduce some contrast mm-hmm. to that.
Mm-hmm.
We are not. This is not 100%. We literally have hate crime, you know, events here in mm-hmm. this area. We've had one very recently. That's
a murder.
Yes, a murder of a young trans woman. And so there's not only, you know, a more supportive environment, but we still have those elements here that are very real.
Mm-hmm.
We're not 100% safe here by any stretch.
No, yeah, and it's I think that it would be a fantasy to imagine that Portland is some sort of a mecca. I mean, a mecca would be like, I remember when I was growing up queer, and I remember hearing about like attempts to create like totally queer towns. Like mm-hmm. there was like this one town in Vermont that was supposed to be like this entire town of lesbians. And I was like, oh, that sounds so great.
Yeah.
An entire town of lesbians is just amazing. So what if we had like an entire city full of queer people? That would just be, oh my gosh, that would be such a dream. But, you know, Portland is not that.
No,
Portland is just, but when you experience life from day to day and you can go someplace where you might go to the convenience store and the person behind the counter is trans, or, you know, you've got a Q center you can go to,
yes,
or you've got a Basic Rights Oregon that's like advocating for your rights legislatively, and where, you know, you can get married, you can you have several choices for healthcare providers,
state IDs. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And these are all, the thing is that these are all new. I mean, that's in spite of what's happening on the federal level right now, in spite of the kind of rhetoric that's coming out of the federal administration, all of these things are happening locally. I mean, they've happened in the last 10 years.
Yes.
In spite of anything that's happening federally.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because we've been working on it. It's a collective effort. All of the trans men in our community, all of the trans women, all of the non-binary people, the gender fluid folks, our allies, working together yeah. or even separately,
yeah.
doing popular education, you know, speaking, forming all kinds of organizations. This is what really makes a community strong. And even though, like, within the broader context of like a large metropolis, it's not that noticeable, for people within our community, it's very noticeable. So in spite of what happens at the federal level, this is still a really positive thing that's happening locally.
Mm-hmm. And it's a reflection of a cultural evolution that's, you know, politics and law don't always really, they're not the leaders.
No, we're the leaders. I mean, we're not the leaders. You and me, but like our,
yeah.
I mean, our trans millennial,
yes.
non-binary
yes.
millennial,
yeah.
you know, people of color, white, gender fluid,
yes.
Hispanic, you know, mm-hmm. not, I mean, people who are from other countries.
Yeah, two observations uh-huh. from this part of our conversation, Emma. Not the least of which is intersectionality, mm-hmm. Which is a term that's used a lot in advocacy work, and realizing that in order to have any kind of viable influence, we have to do so as a coalition. We have to recognize our similarities and our situational, positions, and form alliances in our own mutual interests. That's huge, and a lot of what happens, I think, in media. I think there, anyway, and even culturally, is to contrast that is polarization. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of efforts out there to keep us separated,
right.
fighting amongst ourselves.
Yes, to keep us separate.
Keep us fighting amongst ourselves. Mm-hmm. So that's a contrast. But the other point that I wanted to make, I lost it.
That's okay.
Yeah, but you know, the intersectionality and the need. Oh yeah,
It came back.
Speaking of coalitions, you know, LGBTIQ, you know, that's
right.
a descriptor mm-hmm. of a coalition.
Right.
It's not necessarily even a community. It's a coalition. Moving things forward in terms of shared interests. And specifically, I think what we're seeing now with, awareness around human rights in general, when we speak about what more commonly gets called trans rights, really it's just human rights, we are... kind of enjoying the benefits of the cultural shift that happened in the 90s mm-hmm. around sexual orientation in this country. Basically what happened was the queer community kind of got accepted into the broader cultural
right.
context. More representation in television shows and movies and, mm-hmm. and that kind of stuff. And it humanized us.
It did. It really did.
It humanized us mm-hmm. in the eyes of at least a broader segment of the larger culture. There's still the very polarized elements in this culture that will never... probably ever make
right.
that shift.
Mm-hmm.
But so trans advocacy really is the imagery that comes to my mind is, geese flying in a V.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many people realize that's they're all in each other's slipstreams there, and
oh, right.
they take turns in being in point in
wow.
those Vs. It's to make everybody else behind them's flight a little bit easier, especially the younger ones, especially uh-huh. the older ones. That's why they fly in a V.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
I think that's a good metaphor for what's going on with us as a broader coalition.
Wow, that's a great, yeah, that's a great narrative. That really is. That's a good metaphor. You're listening to Transpositive here on KBOO Community Radio. Tonight we're participating in a day of programming. We're talking about basically the disaster of the Trump administration and how transgender, non-binary, two-spirit people of color, all kinds of communities have been suffering, and what kind of resilient response have we had to the last 3 years of, this broad-based fascist attack on our rights and our communities. So, and I'm here tonight. I'm talking with Jean Bryant. We're co-hosts here of Transpositive, and we're just kind of reflecting back on the last 3 years of programming because these conversations have been constant conversations. We've been having these conversations every week for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
Ever since the disaster happened. And I think that, you know, to flip it over to some of the positive stuff for a minute, you know, there's been a lot of legislative advocacy that's been happening in spite of what's going on at the federal level and actually happening at the federal level. One of the things that I think is a real bright spot in the legislature 2019 was the passage of the Equality Act.
In the House,
yeah, exactly, not in the Senate. But the Equality Act is one of those acts that would like level the playing field on so many of these issues that we're working on, whether it's bathrooms or equal rights in the workplace or job protection, IDs, access to health care. It's a very broad-based piece of federal legislation. And it's also supported in the Senate. It was supported by Senator Merkley and by Senator Wyden. And even though it hasn't been voted on in the U.S. Senate, eventually, when there's a majority in the Senate of people who are friendly to this issue, it can be voted on and it can pass if it's passed in the House and the Senate, and we have a friendly administration in the White House. It would really transform. It would go from the paper-thin veneer of an executive order, which, as you can see, is a tool that can be used two different kinds of ways.
Oh, yes, it can.
The executive order that was used during the Obama administration was kind of a soft pen. It was a way of taking issues that we've been advocating for across the country and, like, you know, kind of giving us a quick go-to. Like, here's how you can kind of slide underneath and get to where you need to go. So it's kind of a workaround, but it didn't really fix the problem. And then when the Trump administration came along, they said, oh, you know, we're going to use this, we're going to slash these executive orders. And so we became kind of tools of propaganda, honestly, for fascists.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, they just as any advocacy group needs a rallying point, okay? Mm-hmm. We all do. This is true from no matter what perspective you look at it when it comes to the whatever the war of words and the competition for getting people to join you. We've been used as a political football. Absolutely, we have. And not just with this current administration. I think that, you know, that basically started a few years before that, certainly from the right wing, using us as a rallying point to get their voting bloc to the polls. God help us.
Mm-hmm.
God us.
If you
help
believe
us.
In God, sorry.
If this administration is not enough
God,
of a rallying point for us to get our interests to the polls, oh my goodness, I just so pray, I just so hope that we don't rehash so much of what went on in 2016 that was divisive, that prevented us, you know, and led us to where we are today, with a federal judicial system now that has been stacked.
Yeah.
A Supreme Court that's going to go on for decades.
Yes.
Those kinds of things that it's... It was an abject failure, 2016. That's what it was. It was an abject failure from the center left coalition to come forward and just be there. I mean, for God's sake, something as simple as going to vote.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, but, oh my goodness. The last 3 years is not enough to get us to pull together,
mm-hmm.
And realize that we can't do this as small factions.
Mm-hmm.
We have to do it as a coalition.
Right. Right. And we have to do it as a coalition across all kinds of lines, including within our own queer communities.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Don't let the SOBs, you know, make you so despondent that it's like this is pointless.
Right.
It's not pointless.
Right.
It absolutely is the point.
Yeah. It's a great inspirational space to get organized and to, you know, get activated, to get radicalized.
Uh-huh.
It's a great, I mean, what's been happening, especially, you know, the dark picture that you're not painting, you're just basically stating the facts of reality of what's happened to the courts and what's happened, you know, to the judiciary, is really depressing. And it's one of the low points. I don't think that we've begun to see how it's going to affect our communities.
Oh, no.
In terms of
not yet.
Court rulings.
We're still waiting to hear, you know, from the U.S. Supreme Court, its rulings on the three cases that were presented in early October of 2019.
Right.
That could be, these could be landmark decisions that will frame the political, not political, the legal playing field for LGBT rights.
Right.
Moving forward. I mean, it's going to take a lot of work to undo a really negative decision coming out of this court.
It could. I mean, I think, so let's talk about that for a minute just to kind of give our listeners an understanding if they're not already aware of what the case was, especially the employment discrimination case.
Yeah.
That was a case that happened in the last 3 years. It was a transgender woman who transitioned in the middle of her her tenure at her workplace, where she worked as, I believe she was
a funeral home.
Yeah, she was either a director or an assistant at a funeral home. And eventually she was released, and she claims that she was released because the funeral home discriminated against her based on her gender identity. And the case that she's brought that's gone all the way to the Supreme Court has to do with discrimination on the basis of sex and the idea that...
In employment.
The idea that her gender identity, which is female, is discriminated against her, is a form of sex discrimination. And so, therefore, it is covered under the same rules that protect women in the workplace. And one of the fears of this, the undoing of this case, if it was overruled, one of the fears is that it would not only undo protections for transgender women, but would also undo protections for all women, which is just completely insane if you think about it. But it's very much in line with what the administration is trying to do to women's rights.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I want to speak from a broader perspective too as a woman, and not just as a transgender woman, but as a woman, someone who has identified as a woman and has been, you know, in my own experience of life, has been female my entire life. You know, the attacks that are happening on women's rights right now are to me actually more concerning in so many ways than anything else that's happening, because the administration is trying to push back women's progress in, mm-hmm. in like almost every way in this country,
mm-hmm.
but most significantly by taking away the right of people, women and other categories of people, other categories of identity from being able to exercise their own reproductive choices regarding whether or not they have children, how they have children, when they have children, if they can afford it. All of those things are just under attack by the right wing, and they've gotten so far with their power and with their planning that they're starting to have some successes, especially in the South. I mean, they're not successes, they're disasters.
Yeah, they've been emboldened. You know, this erosion has been going on now for a little while. Mm-hmm. And I choose that word specifically because erosion happens so subtly in small increments that many of these things don't really rise to the level of people's awareness. Mm-hmm. They're subtle things, but you know, they're repeated time and time and time over again that eventually chip away, and you know. So here's the deal: some of these interests of our detractors. Those folks have been emboldened by a chain of what they consider to be successes. Mm-hmm. And
they're
when
Pyrrhic
I say
victories, in my opinion.
Yeah, and when I say emboldened, what that means is, well, nobody seems to care enough, you know, we must be right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? If those of us whose interests are being eroded can't rise to the level of defending, you know, or making a big deal out of it, then the other side's going to take their half out of the middle. Mm-hmm. That's just nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's been happening.
Mm-hmm. And I think if we look at what's been happening to the erosion specifically of women's rights in this country, mm-hmm. We can see the playbook for an attack on transgender rights.
Oh, sure.
And an attack on LGBTQ rights more broadly.
Yeah.
If we look at how it's been happening, especially in the South, but also nationally,
yeah.
You know, people are so, I mean, there's been such a concerted effort by the far right, by the
yes.
extreme right, by fascists and the far right to control women and to control women's bodies. And they do it one step at a time legislatively, you know, having a 24-hour hold on your ability to exercise your reproductive choice, saying that you can only go see a doctor if they're in a hospital that has certain kinds of admitting privileges, no federal funding. It's a whole series of concerted
yes.
attacks that's designed each one on its own
mm-hmm.
Electorally. You know, doing away with most of the Civil Rights Voting Act, you know,
allowing voter suppression, yeah.
creating state IDs mm-hmm. that, like, you know, you're required to exactly voter suppression. So these are all part of a concerted effort to basically control women mm-hmm. and to control women's bodies and also to control people of color.
Yeah. And so a couple of thoughts. Again, metaphorically, this is pulling on the loose pieces of yarn and unraveling the sweater. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what this is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is not just Emma Lugo and Jean Bryant sitting here flapping, you know, conspiracy theories.
This is what's happening. This is
well,
history.
It is what's happening. It's observable. And the thing is that this right-wing manifesto, it's available. It's out mm-hmm. there.
Right.
I mean, we're not making any of this stuff up. Mm-hmm. This playbook has been published.
Mm-hmm.
If you care, you know, the Heritage Foundation. I mean, this goes and it goes back decades.
Mm-hmm.
This is not new. This has been a systemic,
mm-hmm.
progressive. I don't mean progressive.
Regressive.
Regressive. Yeah. Playbook.
Yeah.
And it's been masterfully played.
Yeah.
I got to give them that.
Well,
I got to give them that.
They're
playing a masterful chess game here.
It helps to be rich and white and male.
Yes, it does.
And conservative
yep.
in America.
Yep.
A country founded on slavery and theft of land. You know, they all just go hand in hand so beautifully.
Yes.
But we as queer and trans people, the reason I started at least this part of our conversation is because that playbook that is being used against women and against people of color, especially in the South, is the exact same playbook that they're going to mm-hmm. be using against us. Mm-hmm. Right now we have the benefit of kind of being on the front end of a tidal wave of support, because we've created like a new world. We're in the process of expanding space. We're expanding the universe of what's possible for people, because we've always been here, but we haven't always been accepted. And now we're accepted, at least on some level. We're accepted. We're in popular media. We're in social media. We're present everywhere. We're legal. We're not like in the back mm-hmm. closet somewhere. And yeah. So we're riding on a, culturally, we're riding on a wave of popular acceptance. I mean, not everywhere in America, but we've been accepted enough that we're like on the leading edge, you know? And so that's happening. But at the same time, there's this other force pushing back, this force of fascism, really. That's how I call it. It's fascism, but it's this force that's pushing back, and it's pushing back from a center of power that's rooted in, you know, it's really rooted in the things that founded this country: slavery, the theft of land, capitalism, mm-hmm. The things that, you know, basically created a center of power that was strong enough to push out Native Americans, to take people and stick them in factories and take away their rights, to create sharecroppers, you know, to steal land, to destroy our planet. And those forces...
To burden now, I think, two generations with economic student debt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a good one, student debt.
And all of those forces are, you know, pushing against our trans and our queer communities. But they're going to follow the same playbook.
Because they're crushing. That, mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're going to follow the same playbook that they did with the erosion of women's rights and the rights of people of color, of civil rights, legislatively. And the way that they're going to do it is that they're going to target school districts. They're going to target city councils. They're going to target state legislatures and try to push against us in each one of those spaces. So in every one of those spaces where they push against us, we need to push back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, for me, that's really the takeaway. Like the thing that I really want to make sure to get out talking about 3 years of Trump is that what we're learning is that we have to push back in every way that they push against us. So we need to be running for city council. We
yes.
need to be running for school board. We need to be paying attention to our advocacy groups when they come to us and say, hey, this is what's going on in my community. They're trying to pass a bill right now so that trans kids can't use the bathroom. Or they're trying to pass a law so that they're trying to pass a regulation in our school district so that trans kids don't have access to medically appropriate services, such as hormone blockers, to even to information in their school districts. You know, because there's lots of school districts mm-hmm. where they don't even want to have the kind of language that, you know, validates our identities as people.
Mm-hmm.
They want to pretend that we don't exist. And their school districts, they want to elect people in their school districts who will say, I'm proudly against this transgender fad. I'm against this, you know, this agenda, this LGBTQ agenda, which is really a conspiracy against our Christian values. Which is the kind of conversations that are happening right now in our country. And, you know, from my perspective, from my tradition, that's actually that when you enter that point in the narrative, that means that you're actually the most powerful person in the room, because you've entered into the heart of these people's spaces where they think that you're a threat. And that sense of being a threat means that what you're really doing is you're really confronting their fear. You're really confronting their fear of something that they don't know. They think it's an unknown. It's something that is it's something that creates fear and uncertainty. And really, it's a point of liberation because you're expanding their understanding of what people are. You're really opening their mind beyond what they've been colonized to think they're supposed to be. And so to me, that's like how we're actually in the center of a narrative. And so we're, as trans and queer and non-binary people, we actually have just an incredibly important role to play. We're actually really in the middle of this conversation, and we're kind of helping to lead the way because we're expanding people's understanding of what human beings are and how we exist beyond what they were trained to think we are. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, and I think that's a narrative that all of us just kind of intuitively understand as queer folks. I mean, we have, in a way, we kind of have like this group mind, like we're just able to almost be telepathic with each other because we understand that our existence is liberatory. It's something that, like, really, you know, it's amazing to know that we exist and that we have the potential to transform the world around us through our fabulousness. So that's a nice thing, you know, and we're part of that conversation, but our existence, like, really elicits fear in people. And
yes, it does.
And part of what we're doing, like the long, long arc of our work, is overcoming, like helping to push that fear over into joy. That's how I see it. Yeah. Anyways.
That we are not a threat to some of these other interests, in at least not in the way that they perceive us. No. As a threat.
No.
We are not. And that the broader human experience is going to be better.
Yes.
For everyone, them included.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very complex, multi-layered, multifaceted conglomeration of things.
Yes.
And it's really hard to speak about it meaningfully, other than in such a broad way as what I just phrased it.
Mm-hmm.
We have to demonstrate, you know, words are just words. Actions speak louder than words.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that brings me back to the whole idea of humanizing some of, you know, the minority voices, humanizing. And that's what, you know, I mean, we're part of a coalition, of a wave, of a movement, and I think and it's not just in this country.
Oh no,
it's absolutely not just in this country. That's another thing that we have to realize, that this same general expansion of the human condition, or the potential, is a worldwide thing that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, yeah.
And it's always been happening. That's the thing, too. It's always been happening. We've always been here.
Yeah, a lot of times there's two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah.
You know.
That's true.
One of my genisms there, but...
A genism.
A genism.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. This is Trans Positive, and we're just at the very tail end. We've only got about maybe 3 or 4 minutes left. We've been talking about... basically 3 years of disaster, 3 years of the Trump administration and its disaster, and how it's affected the transgender community, non-binary community, people of color, women,
yep.
All kinds of folks. And what are we specifically seeing as transgender and non-binary folks? And also, how are we resisting? How are we pushing back? And we've been pushing back in a lot of ways. We've
gotten, yes, we have.
Lots and lots of we've gotten lots of elected officials in the last 3 years, starting with Danica Roem.
Yeah, Emma, you know, I think, again, another, I think, great one-liner summary. We will not be erased.
Mm-hmm. We've been out in the streets. We've been protesting.
We will not be erased.
We've been in city halls.
Mm-hmm.
We've been on television. We've been in the workplaces. We've been visible.
In spite of what I think are very legitimate fears.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, I mean, that's bravery, mm-hmm. you know, to be able to, you know, step up on your own behalf and in behalf of your brothers and sisters mm-hmm. out there, you know, in spite of your fears.
And we've been here at KBOO too, so
yeah,
that's been great. So Gene, we've only got a couple of minutes left. What are a couple of takeaways we can give people, like things to look forward to in the next year?
I think we can look forward to a different voter turnout this time.
I think so.
I genuinely feel that mm-hmm. people realize mm-hmm. what happened last time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that voters are definitely getting more motivated. And we're seeing trans folks running for office, which I think is great. These are two really big takeaways, is that trans folks and queer folks are understanding that we need to be involved in all levels mm-hmm. of government.
Yeah, and not just running, winning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, running and winning.
And running exactly. and winning.
But you can't win unless you run, so.
That's, yep.
And you can't win unless you vote. So if you haven't registered to vote, go to the Oregon Secretary of State website here in the state of Oregon and make sure that you've registered to vote for the 2020 elections. Here in Portland, I think, I'm not sure when the deadline is, but the mayoral election is in May. And also city council. So make sure that you get registered by whenever that deadline is. And if you want to vote in the national election, make sure you get registered to vote by, I think it's like sometime in October.
Yeah. And to echo your point from earlier in this conversation, Emma, we're not just talking about voting in the presidential election.
No. Vote in your local elections too. Look at who's running for your city council. Look at who's running for your school board. I mean, those elections get less than 10% public participation.
Your state sometimes. And local elections are equally important. We've been living with gerrymandering, redistricting mm-hmm. of congressional districts, those kind of things. Those a lot of folks, civics lesson. Those things are set.
Your vote matters.
Yeah, your vote matters.
So thank you so much for joining us tonight on Trans Positive. Thanks so much and have a great night.
Hey.
It's like sugar, so sweet. You're listening to KBOO KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 7 p.m. Next up is Calculated Conversation with David and Ken. The show has been pre-recorded, so if you call in, they won't be here to take your call. The last half of the show is about hindsight 2020. Enjoy.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of In the Blast Zone, a panel on tar sands by rail on Tuesday, January 21st from 7 to 9 p.m. at Patagonia in Portland. In 2018, the Zenith Energy Oil Terminal opened, the first tar sands by rail export terminal on the West Coast. The Center for a Sustainable Economy hosts this panel discussion with activists fighting tar sands by rail in the Pacific Northwest. Again, that's In the Blast.